Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is September 30, 1982, and this is my audio letter number 79. Throughout the Middle Ages, the Christians of Central Europe shared a terrible fear, which is all but forgotten today. It was a fear which caused Christian parents to exercise special care over their children at the time of the Jewish holy day of Passover. Their greatest dread was that their child might be kidnapped and never seen again. Because it was widely believed that the Jews practiced human sacrifice at Passover and that the victims were Christian children. That ancient blood fear of the Jews by Christians largely died out in the centuries following the Renaissance. Today, most Christians are shocked to learn that any such belief ever existed. As for the Jews themselves, there is a rabbinical term that is used to condemn the ancient Christian blood fear. It is called blood libel. For generations now, the old issue of blood libel has been essentially a dead one, a thing of the past. No Jew in his right mind would want it otherwise. To revive the issue of blood libel is to resurrect ancient fears, unreasoning passions, and mortal danger to every Jew alive. Yes, most Jews would be better off if they never again heard about the ancient Christian blood fear of the Jews. But this month, none other than the government of Israel has deliberately revived the so-called blood libel issue. Over the weekend of September 17, Israeli forces introduced so-called Christian militiamen into two Palestinian refugee camps in West Beirut. The result was a massacre of over 1,000 Palestinian civilians, including many women, children, and elderly people. Word of the massacre reached the outside world on the evening of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, September 18. An outraged world blamed the Begin government for allowing such a heinous crime to take place. The Israeli government's official reply to the world was a statement issued on Sunday, September 19. It was published 2 days later as a full-page advertisement in major American newspapers with the headline, Blood Libel. The statement began with the words, and I quote, "On the New Year, Rosh Hashanah, a blood libel was leveled against the Jewish state, its government, and the Israeli Defense Forces, otherwise known as the IDF. The statement then continued with a series of statements which only days later were proven to be total lies. The official Israeli government statement said the massacre took place, quote, in an area where there was no position of the Israeli army, unquote. Yet the very next day after this statement was published, the Israeli Defense Minister Sharon flatly contradicted it. On September 22, Sharon admitted that the Israelis not only introduced the militiamen into the camps, but also supported them with airborne flares. The official Israeli government advertisement also said, quote, as soon as the IDF learned of the tragic events, Israeli soldiers put an end to the slaughter, unquote. That too was a lie, and numerous reports have already surfaced to show that it was a lie. The fact is that the Israeli troops had orders to surround and cut off the two Palestinian camps, while the militiamen did the dirty work. From start to finish, top Israeli officials knew exactly what was going on. They had ordered the entire operation and were kept informed of its progress. By calling the accusations against it blood libel, the Begin government acknowledged that the Beirut massacre was a subhuman act of bloodthirsty evil. But the transparent lies about it by the Begin government reflect the fact that the charges against it are not libel, they are the truth. My friends, it's no accident that the Beirut massacre was centered around Friday, September 17. In Audio Letter 78 last month, I reported that September 17 was scheduled to be a day of nuclear massacre. That was the day when the super-secret Project Z nuclear war plan was to be set off. If all had gone according to plan, a surprise American nuclear first strike against Russia was scheduled for that day. But by the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, all did not go according to plan. The Project Z nuclear strike plan was finally aborted, for now that is, around mid-morning September 17, the countdown clock stopped less than 5 hours short of nuclear war one. The final decision to abort the strike ended a week of fierce debate at the top levels of the Reagan-Begin axis of Bolsheviks and Zionists. Meanwhile, another war plan has already been set in motion to replace it. The Beirut massacre, which was underway on September 17, is a key ingredient in the new military intrigues now underway. But the massacre was also motivated by sheer insane frenzy. It was the blind frenzy of satanic and demonic forces who saw their goal of nuclear victory slip away just when it seemed within their grasp. My three special topics for this audio letter are: topic number one, the aborted plan for surprise nuclear war; topic number two, the Beirut massacre for war to come; and topic number three, the return of the Siberia Express weather war. Topic number one. When I recorded audio letter 78 late last month, I made public the final Pentagon plans for nuclear war one to erupt this month, September 1982. The Pentagon war planners were counting down toward Friday, September 17, to set off nuclear war as a complete surprise. But as the final days ticked away this month, major snags began to develop in the rush-rush war timetable. Finally, the decision was made to scrub the planned nuclear first strike against Russia virtually at the last minute. As I reported last month, the first H-bombs were to be detonated on key Russian targets at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on September 17. The order to scrub the attack went out less than 5 hours before that, shortly after 10 a.m. that morning. When a decision finally came to abort the attack, it was a judgment call. And that judgment was far from popular with some members of the elite Bolshevik war planning team in the Pentagon. The snags which developed this month were very serious, but not serious enough to completely rule out an attempted nuclear strike. As a result, the war planning group became splintered into acrimonious debate over what to do. No one argued in favor of giving up the basic goal of attacking Russia, but there was a sharp division over how best to save the nuclear war plan. Basically, the argument boiled down to two alternatives, whether to postpone the nuclear strike or whether to go ahead as planned. The hotheads insisted that the surprise nuclear attack against Russia should proceed on schedule on September 17. They argued that in spite of the problems which had cropped up, delay would only give time for even more obstacles to develop. They also pointed out that their intelligence on Russian targets will gradually grow stale with delay. In effect, they said, now is our best chance. The more conservative faction among the war planners insisted that the hotheads were not thinking straight. In their view, the hitches which developed this month in the war plan were too serious to go ahead now. Better to wait and reschedule the Project Z war plan after removing the present obstacles to success. The debate began to tip in favor of a postponement 1 week before the September 17 target date. For that reason, other contingency plans were set in motion in the Middle East during that final week. But the nuclear strike plan remained in effect right down to the wire. In the end, it was an accumulation of many factors which finally caused the plan to be aborted. The Bolsheviks here started running into trouble in their rush-rush nuclear war plan almost as soon as it started, early this year of 1982. I first reported that a shortcut nuclear war strategy was being implemented by the Pentagon 7 months ago in audio letter 72. At the same time, I also reported that the Rockefeller cartel and the Russians were lining up to try to stop the war plan. To that end, they had agreed to start working together against the American Bolsheviks in certain ways. On top of that, a coup d'etat was brewing here in Washington to be led by General Alexander Haig, then Secretary of State. In the 7 months since I recorded audio letter 72, world headlines repeatedly have been filled with the consequences of this three-way struggle. First came the Falklands War last April, which was not about sheep and settlers, but about secret weapons installations. The secret Pentagon war plan received a severe blow in that skirmish, but the Bolsheviks here soon struck back. In June, they destroyed the Hague coup d'état. At the same time, the brutal Israeli invasion of Lebanon was underway, right on the timetable which I had made public last year, and which Sharon, Defense Minister of Israel, confirmed only this week in the Knesset. And then there was the fourth space shuttle, which carried the Defense Department payload into orbit to prepare for war. By midsummer, leaders of both America and Russia were making statements that the superpowers were already at war. The Russians started firing warning shots across America's bow by way of weather modification, airplane disasters, and more. Finally, last month on August 12, the Russians used sheer intimidation to thwart the Israeli plan for an incredibly bloody invasion of Beirut. Suddenly, the PLO evacuation talks bore fruit, and the evacuation went off without a hitch. It was a serious blow to the joint Bolshevik-Zionist efforts to create an atmosphere of mushrooming crisis as a prelude to nuclear war. For about 2 weeks, the atmosphere of world crisis appeared to almost evaporate, but the Pentagon war clock was still counting down toward September 17, and the Russians knew it. On September 2, the Soviet Union abruptly disconnected all direct dial telephone service to and from the West. Instead, military operators took over. It was an extension of the telephone cutbacks which had begun months earlier. To the top Pentagon war strategists, the Russian telephone service cutback of September 2 seemed like small potatoes. They had bigger things to worry about, namely a serious turn of events in Red China. The previous day, September 1, Communist Party Chairman Hu Yaobang had dropped a bombshell at the Party Congress in Peking. He declared that China should no longer ally itself with the United States against Russia. Instead, Hu said China should regard both superpowers as equal threats. But at the same time, he included some conciliatory language toward Russia. And, my friends, high Russian officials will go to China to begin talks in 2 weeks' time at China's invitation. By disowning the Sino-American alliance, Hu Yaobang made it clear that the secret American stealth attack base in China was in jeopardy. That base, located in Red China's western Xinjiang province, is essential for the intended attack on Russia's two Cosmosphere bases in Siberia. Last month I reported that this war base was the reason for the joint communique of August 17 by the United States and Red China concerning Taiwan. The communique commits the United States to discontinue arms deliveries to Taiwan at some future date in violation of Reagan's past pledges. The communique was agreed to in order to head off a threatened shutdown of the stealth base by the Chinese, but it was not enough to satisfy the Chinese. On September 6, former President Richard Nixon arrived in Peking, adding further to the troubles of the Pentagon war planners. Nixon has long been a client follower of the Rockefeller cartel, as I detailed in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, nearly 10 years ago. Nixon went to Peking this month as a Rockefeller envoy, and one with far more credibility for the Chinese than anyone the Bolsheviks have. Nixon shocked the Chinese by confirming what Russian sources had already told them, that the stealth base was about to be used in war. Nixon then counseled them not to shut down the base outright at this time for fear of undesirable reactions by the trigger-happy Pentagon Bolsheviks. Instead, he urged the Chinese to start interfering with operation of the stealth base by bureaucratic devices. That is one thing the Chinese are very good at, and they accepted Nixon's advice. By September 9, the American stealth base in Xinjiang Province, China was effectively out of action. Critical base personnel were tangled up in Chinese red tape, preventing them from reporting for duty. The Chinese are giving hints to Washington that all this is due to continued dissatisfaction over Taiwan. But the real reason, my friends, is that they want no part of nuclear war with Russia. The Kremlin received word through Rockefeller channels on September 9 that the Xinjiang Province stealth base had been effectively neutralized. At that point, the Russians could rest assured that even if the Pentagon went through with its nuclear attack plan, Russia's Cosmospheres would survive. Russia's critical space triad of strategic weapons could no longer be destroyed. The time had come to carry out the most dangerous step in the Kremlin plan to unravel the Pentagon nuclear war plan. The time had come to destroy the attack confirmation sensor placed in space by the space shuttle last June. The attack confirmation sensor was a special satellite placed in geostationary orbit over the Indian Ocean by an auxiliary rocket. As I've reported before, it was a cryogenic satellite. That is, it was maintained at super cold temperatures, close to absolute zero. I can now reveal that this was intended to protect the satellite from detection by Russian space weapons. For several years now, American scientific intelligence analysts have known that the Russians have a new technology for target acquisition. The new Russian technique is not radar, nor is it any other conventional means of detecting and tracking targets. The new Russian technique is deadly accurate, reliable, and unlike radar, impossible to jam. Analysts here some time ago convinced themselves that they had figured out what the new Russian technique is. They believe it is a Russian version of computer-enhanced infrared detection. This has now been developed here in the United States and is called SEER, C-E-I-R. I first reported on this development in Audio Letter 72, shortly after a SEER-equipped American laser was used to shoot down a Russian Cosmosphere. American analysts are convinced that the Russians are using SEER and that they had it first. And so when the Air Force attack confirmation sensor was designed, it was given a feature intended to defeat Russian infrared detectors. All objects warmer than absolute zero emit infrared radiation. The warmer the object is, the more infrared it emits, and the easier it is for computer-enhanced infrared sensors to detect it. The only way to hide from SEER is therefore to reduce the temperature as low as possible. That's why the Air Force attack confirmation sensor was a cryogenic satellite. A huge cooling system using liquid helium kept the satellite only a few degrees above absolute zero, reducing infrared emissions to nearly nothing. The cryogenic design of the Air Force satellite is what gave the Bolshevik war planners here so much confidence that it would succeed. They were sure that the Russians would be unable to find it in time to destroy it before it was used in war. But, my friends, the Bolsheviks in the Pentagon are wrong about the new Russian target tracking technique. It is not an infrared technique at all. Instead, it's a revolutionary system which detects the atomic vibrations of matter. The Russians call it psychoenergetic range finding, or PRF. When I first reported on Russia's new PRF technique in Audio Letter 42, I reported that the Russians regard it as their master secret weapon. The longer it remains a mystery to the American Bolsheviks, the better it will be for Russia. And so when Space Shuttle 4 launched the Air Force cryogenic sensor last June, the Russians started playing a game. Instead of destroying the satellite right away, they allowed it to be orbited successfully. The Russians knew that the attack confirmation satellite could do them no harm until war itself was about to begin. So they allowed it to stay there untouched for as long as possible. The result was exactly as expected. The long-term survival of the Air Force sensor has convinced the Bolsheviks here that they were right about Russia using SEER. The Pentagon has walked into a major intelligence blunder, and the Russians are encouraging them to keep it up. Throughout the summer, Rockefeller cartel operatives within the CIA fed updates about the Pentagon war plan to the Russians. Those reports continued to say that the war timetable was remaining unchanged, targeted for mid-September, so the Russian Space Command left the Air Force sensor alone for the time being. Meanwhile, the Russians began preparing, in a totally unsuspected way, for the moment when they would destroy the satellite. Those preparations had to do with Russia's international telephone service. First in June, the Soviet Union drastically reduced the number of telephone links to the West. They also made clouded threats to reduce service still further at a later date. In order to keep the intelligence analysts here from guessing what was afoot, the Russians resorted to a little disinformation in the right places. They created falsified leaks that there were unsettled conditions in the Kremlin, a power struggle. The Bolsheviks here, who are always struggling for power, swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. The next major step was the one I mentioned earlier on September 2. That was the day when Russia suddenly cut off all automatic dialing service to and from the West. The Bolsheviks here were startled but still did not suspect what it really meant. They were too preoccupied with rumblings of trouble in China to worry for long about Russia's telephones. For the final step, the Kremlin waited, hoping that the maneuvers to disrupt the stealth base in Tsingkiem province would succeed. On September 9, they received a mission accomplished signal from the Rockefeller cartel. The Tsingkiem base was temporarily incapacitated thanks to Nixon's recommended bureaucratic entanglement by the Chinese. The next morning, Friday, September 10, there was a sudden total shutdown of most international telephone service to and from Russia. But in order to send a message to America's Bolshevik war planners, a few selected circuits were kept open. Those included Leningrad, Kiev, Minsk, and Tallinn. Their significance lay in the fact that none were targets planned for the initial stealth attack which I detailed last month. The phone lines were cut off at 7:10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time or 2:10 p.m. Moscow Time. Moments later, the Russian Space Command went to work. A Russian jumbo Cosmosphere was parked in a pseudo-orbit about 2 miles above the Air Force attack confirmation satellite. It had been there for over 2 months from the moment the satellite was launched into orbit from Space Shuttle 4. By using its electromagnetic propulsion system at low power, the Cosmosphere had remained on station instead of slowly drifting away as a normal satellite would. And parked as it was above the downward-looking Air Force satellite, the presence of the Cosmosphere was never detected. Now the time had come. The Cosmosphere aimed its beam weapon and fired. Shortly after 7:10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Friday, September 10, there was bad news for the Bolsheviks here. At the newly operational Air Force Base Command in Colorado Springs, there was a sudden loss of signal from their Indian Ocean satellite. At first, they could not believe that their critical attack confirmation satellite had been attacked. All sorts of things were tried in an effort to reestablish contact with the satellite, all to no avail. The satellite no longer existed. As that Friday morning of September 10 wore on, the Project Z war planners were convened in crisis conference. The question at hand was, what do we do now? For a while there was an atmosphere of near panic. Some were sure that a first strike by Russia was sure to follow, and that the Pentagon should push the nuclear button without delay. Others argued that if that were the Kremlin's intention, it was already too late. Russia's missiles would be on the way. At the opposite extreme, someone suggested that the whole Project Z war plan be aborted for now and rescheduled later on. Everyone agreed on one thing. Without the attack confirmation sensor, any attack on Russia had become far more risky. After launching the stealth planes from Norway and Turkey, it would just have to be assumed that they had destroyed their targets. With the attack confirmation satellite gone, there would be no way to confirm that, so the all-out follow-up attack by America's nuclear forces might run into a lot more trouble than expected. At that point, someone remarked to the effect, "We can still go with a backup plan. Every target in Russia that is attacked by our birds will be obliterated. If international telephone service to Russian target areas is suddenly cut off at 0 hour, we can assume that our birds made it." There's an old military saying that goes, "There is always someone who didn't get the word." The planner who suggested falling back on the backup plan based on telephones proved once again how true that saying is. Nearly everyone shouted at him, "The phones to Russia are already shut down." My friends, the Russians kept the international phone line shut down for 7 hours that day. They wanted to make sure that if the Pentagon Bolsheviks pushed the panic button, they would obtain no intelligence at all by monitoring telephone circuits. After the first 2 hours or so of the blackout, Secretary of State George Shultz was accosted by reporters about it. Shultz told them, "It is very significant," quote-unquote, but would say no more. By the time Washingtonians were finishing their lunch that day, a decision had been reached about what to do. Project Z would continue on the original schedule, targeted for the following Friday, September 17. Meanwhile, every effort would be made to cut through the Chinese red tape that was restricting use of the critical base in Tsingtian Province. At the same time, it was decided to set other plans in motion too, just in case Project Z should finally fall through. That is how it stood through the week leading up to Z-Day, September 17. The Project Z first strike plan was in deep trouble, yet it was still on track. It had been decided that if nothing else went wrong, the surprise attack on Russia would still be launched on the 17th, come what may. The straw that broke the camel's back came at almost the last possible minute on Friday morning, September 17. At about 8:30 a.m. here in Washington, a well-known national newspaper reporter was interviewed on the Washington NBC radio station WRC. The reporter of the Washington Post called attention to my war warning for that day, contained in audio letter 78. He reportedly outlined the plan briefly for everyone listening in the Washington metropolitan area, and he added that if the Pentagon did have such a plan, public exposure through my tape had probably reduced the chances that it would be carried out. My friends, that radio report here in Washington about the war plan on the morning of September 17 was seemingly a small thing, but our Lord Jesus Christ can always use little things to produce big results. And that is what He did on that morning of Z-Day. Thanks to those of you who had written to editors, congressmen, and officials of all kinds about the war plan, the Pentagon was becoming edgy. The last thing they wanted was public exposure of their war plan. When they heard the report that morning over radio station WRC, they quite simply panicked. They had no way of knowing just how widely their plan had become known. And so shortly after 10 a.m. Washington time, Friday, September 17, 1982, the Project Z first strike was called off. With less than 5 hours to go, the countdown clock for Nuclear War I had finally stopped ticking.